The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. All right, this first article is called From Emma Watson to Marley Dias, O Magazine Names 8 Young Visionaries Shaping Our Future. Do you need a dash of hope? We'll look no further than these movers and shakers who are fired up and ready to go. When 21-year-old Kate Eater was in fourth grade, her gym teacher made the boys and girls play separately. Eater was not a fan. I always thought the boys had more fun, so I convinced my class to get the teacher to let us play together, she says. That was my introduction to the power an individual has to inspire collective action. Now Eater, who founded or co-founded 3 nonprofits before she even started her freshman year at Stanford, is executive director of Future Coalition, a network of youth activists. And there are plenty like her these days. Eater and her peers are making their voices heard, whether they're agitating, creating, or innovating. Though young people have always been at the forefront of revolution, today's up-and-coming generation is fueled by both the organizing power of social media and the weighty burden of an uncertain future. People say, oh, you're so passionate about the climate crisis, says environmental activist Jamie Margolin, 18. But I have to be. It's a ticking time bomb. I don't enjoy thinking about how the sky out west is the wrong color. Young people have also grown up in the information age, and knowledge is power, says Yara Shahidi, 20, whose socially conscious work has led Oprah to hope she'll one day become president of the United States. I think that access to information gives us a level of connectedness and responsibility, says Shahidi. We're in a constant process of bearing witness, and we're also armed with a wider perspective on history. Speaking of history, here are 8 dynamic young women already making it. Emma Watson, 30. The actor who exemplified girl power as wizard Hermione Granger is now a UN Women Goodwill Ambassador, who helped launch the He for She campaign, which supports gender equality. A proponent of ethical and eco-friendly fashion, Watson recently became chair of the Sustainability Committee on the board of French luxury conglomerate Kering, which owns Gucci, among other brands. Watson says, you might be thinking, who is this Harry Potter girl? What is she doing at the UN? Given the chance, I feel it is my duty to say something. Jamie Margolin, 18, co-founder and co-leader of the global climate action organization Zero Hour, Margolin is part of a youth group that is suing Governor Jay Inslee in the state of Washington over greenhouse gas emissions, arguing that they put younger generations in danger. Her activism guide, Youth to Power, was published in June. She says kids think more logically about the environment than adults. Middle school students ask, why isn't pollution illegal? They're right. There is no reason why destroying life on Earth should be something you can get away with. Marley Dias, 15, exasperated by her fifth grade reading list full of titles about white boys and their dogs, Dias founded the hashtag 1000 Black Girl Books campaign, which has gathered more than 12,000 works featuring black female protagonists. The author of Marley Dias Gets It Done now hosts the Netflix series Bookmarks, featuring black celebrities reading black-authored kids' books. Dias says, frustration can be fuel. If we home in on even small things that bother us and realize how they might be part of a larger problem, we can come up with solutions that change the world. Yara Shahidi, 20. Beloved for her role as Zoe in the TV series Blackish and Grownish, Shahidi founded Yara's Club, a digital meetup for high school students to discuss issues surrounding social good. For her 18th birthday, she launched the initiative 18x18, now called hashtag WeVoteNext, which encourages civic engagement and voting among young people. She's also worked with UN Women, Girls for Gender Equity, and the Third Wave Fund. We are entering a world we haven't even imagined before, which can feel both scary and exciting. We're acknowledging and calling out oppressive infrastructures. Reform may not be enough to right the egregious wrongs. It may be about starting over and just shifting the entire paradigm. Miranda Yang, 26. When Wang and her friend Jenny Yao learned that only about 9% of the world's plastic gets recycled, they took on the problem as a high school research project. Now their company, BioCollection, launched in 2015, develops technologies to break down plastics and build them back into consumer products. She says there's always a way to get to a win-win. If people don't see that, they're not aiming high enough or putting in enough creativity. Nyjah Charles, 23. Her songwriting skills, heard on tracks by Beyoncé and Jay-Z, Cardi B, Megan Thee Stallion, and more, have earned her 7 Grammy nominations. Rain on Me, performed by Lady Gaga and Ariana Grande, hit number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100. She says, I think the energy for youth activism comes from us having to learn so young about the world, the economic crisis, a whole other civil rights movement. But people also need healing. Everything that's going on has inspired me to write more joyful songs. Sarah Mora, 24. In 2017, activist Mora, who came to the U.S. from Costa Rica at age 3, revealed that she was a DACA recipient, aiming to shatter the stigma surrounding undocumented immigrants. Her new nonprofit, Population Mike, focuses on areas such as voter suppression and offers scholarships for residents of low-income communities. I'm always thinking, there's some kid out there saying, that's who I am. To see undocumented people living publicly and fearlessly, that's what I needed when I was 14. Katie Eater, 21. At 13, Eater founded Kids Tales to bring writing workshops to young people. At 18, she co-founded the anti-gun violence nonprofit, 50 Miles More. Currently, she's executive director of Future Coalition, which she co-founded, a youth network addressing issues such as climate change. She says, in Judaism, there's a Hebrew phrase, tikkun olam, which means to repair the world. That value was built into me growing up. I always felt this obligation that if you see something wrong, you should do something to try to fix it. All right, this next article is called How Sagittarius Season and 2 Eclipses Will Affect Your Zodiac Sign. This season will be wild, says astrologer Chani Nicholas, even more so than most. Sagittarius Season. Sagittarius, the fire sign that loves to wow a crowd, likes to set out on great adventures and experience the new, and it arrived on November 21st. Like all of the parties it throws, this season will be wild, but even more so than most, because it brings 2 eclipses. First, a penumbral lunar eclipse in Gemini on November 30th, and then a total solar eclipse in Sagittarius on December 14th. Eclipses signal times of change in the world and in our lives. They usher in new beginnings and bring about significant endings. They churn, disturb, and are somewhat chaotic in their impact, but for good reason. Eclipses bring up what would otherwise stay relegated to the shadows. When the light of the sun or moon is blocked, obscured, or obstructed, like it is during eclipses, we get a different view of our surroundings, revealing our personal and collective shadows. Eclipses mark moments in the year that we should pay attention to, for what happens under them has a way of making a lasting impression. The first eclipse on November 30th isn't visually stunning, but it is nonetheless important. In Gemini, this lunar eclipse, an eclipse during a full moon, will bring a flurry of messages, an influx of information, and an overwhelm of opinions. This eclipse requires discernment. It will magnify the messages we send out, so you'll want to limit gossip. Use your energy to focus on the ideas that you want to flourish and spread the messages that you most want to come around back to you. Otherwise, zip it. The eclipse on December 14th is a total solar eclipse and visible from southern South America, Southwest Africa, and Antarctica. A visually spectacular event, the potency of this day is pronounced. Occurring as the Electoral College confirms the president, this eclipse is especially poignant for the United States. Since eclipses tend to shake things up, the less we have to rid ourselves of, the better. We can all aid the process by engaging in a deep clean between November 29th and December 15th. Think of this time period as one that is preparing us for a fresh start. As Sagittarius and eclipse season come to close, and just after Capricorn season begins on December 21st, we have what is called the Great Conjunction. The Great Conjunction, Jupiter conjunct Saturn in Aquarius, is an official new beginning, the mark of a new era, and it ushers in a new paradigm. We don't have to wait until January 1st to get a refresh. More on that soon. Until then, trust that what gets left out is not lost. Next, a note about how Sagittarius and eclipse season will be impacting your sign. If you are Aries, eclipse season makes a mockery of your set-in-stone plans. Keep an open mind when your calendar shifts, as there are important projects that need your ideas, input, and articulation. You may find that they have no issue making a little extra room for themselves. Taurus. Your resources get a reboot within the eclipse season. What you have to work with and what you have to share comes into view. It looks like your rates are going up. Or are you just taking more on, increasing your workload and letting your bank statement suffer? Double check the balances of your exchanges. If they don't add up, maybe it's time to redirect your efforts. Okay, if you're a Gemini, you are getting a major upgrade. With an eclipse in your sign on November 30th, you end 2020 with a bang. Not exactly the easiest year. Your victories have been hard won. With this extra attention on you, take note of what feels important to put forward and what you no longer feel you need to prove. Feeling at home in our own skin is the greatest indicator of growth. Relationships also get a reboot, but more than anything, you are being asked to let the truth of your partnership surface so that you can serve them honestly and serve them with integrity. If you are a Cancer, as your behind-the-scenes projects pick up steam, you realize how important it is to redirect your energy. Cleanse yourself of the work projects that were either energy drains or just less than the right fit. Then move definitively toward what needs you most. Gathering your energy and directing it toward your goal is often as good as a rest, but definitely do take naps when and where you can. All right, if you're a Leo, eclipse season brings you a plethora of social situations to sort through. There may be an influx of demands from your networks, making it imperative that you prioritize those that you most want to build with. It also asks you to clear out your creative closets so that you remember the tools that are at your disposal. What you make for the collective needs to come from the heart, but it has its own tempo and timing. This eclipse season reminds you to trust the process, rather than any pressure you unnecessarily put on yourself to perform or produce. All right, Virgos, big career moves are being made. Come the end of November, more likely there will be an overwhelm of directions to take your creations in. Learning how to choose your path is personal, but whatever stage of life you're at, know your reasons for doing so. You shouldn't ever compare your career or its setup to anyone else's, but that is especially true now. Libra. Eclipse season wants you to clear your calendars and ready yourself for what is to come. With big things on the horizon, you need your time and energy back from distracting and unnecessary activities. The less you talk about getting where you need to go, the more energy you have to get there. Keep quiet about what is still forming so that you can better stay attuned to it. Scorpio. With the right collaborations, anything is possible. With ones that are even slightly off, the most prominent possibility can still be a waste of your time. Learning how to discern between the two, follow your gut, and find your way is a learning curve that you're in, and that eclipse season makes even more prominent. The less you invest in what ultimately doesn't serve you, the more energy you have for what does. All right, Sagittarius, Eclipse season is here to remind you that you've got to let some things go in order to grow. Personal reconstructions are underway, your relationships flourish, and partnerships flock to you. You'll have to discern who to take on and who to pass on if you want to make the most of the moment. Those interested in you may have good taste, but it doesn't mean that they are a good fit. Okay, Capricorn. Eclipse season asks you to clear out your psychic closets, say hello to the ghosts that live there, and let yourself off the hook for what happened years ago. You can only fix the past by living in the present with integrity and kindness. Along with a lunar eclipse on November 30th comes an increase of work projects that demand your attention. Many of the issues that come up will be more bark than bite. However, learn to discern what is an emergency and what's just a false alarm. Aquarius, your creative projects get a major boost and your collective projects undergo a necessary clearing. Don't be afraid to take some time out from the group work that is no longer feeding you. Your audiences may be shifting as your new creative projects take shape. One may be out of sync with the other, but a little discomfort isn't necessarily a red flag. Discerning between what isn't working and what just needs adjustment makes all the difference. Okay, Pisces, with a reboot to your career and an expansive addition to your home base, eclipse season asks you to be honest about your needs in both your personal and your professional life. As your root systems develop, you come to understand just how little validation you need from the world. This purification process helps you value your talents and curate the spaces where they are able to take shape and flight. All right, this next article is called Gabrielle Union Says As Long As I Have a Voice, I Will Continue to Speak Up. Earlier this year, Time named Gabrielle Union one of their 100 most influential people of 2020. But as activist Tarana Burke pointed out in her tribute to Union, the actress and mother isn't just influencing, she is intentionally directing her attention, influence, and resources to advance an agenda that deliberately celebrates the most marginalized among us. Throughout a successful career as an actress that has spanned dozens of movies and TV shows from Bring It On to Think Like a Man, Being Mary Jane, and LA's Finest, to name only a few, Union has always used her voice and her platform for something greater than blockbusters. As the founder of her production company, I'll Have Another, she works to produce projects by and for marginalized people. As an actress and public figure, she's led by example, encouraging Black women to fight for their rights in the workplace. In 2013, she sued BET for breach of contract regarding her role in Being Mary Jane, and in 2020, she filed a discrimination lawsuit against America's Got Talent, citing racism and prejudice. And as a citizen, she has been outspoken about everything from the 2012 shooting of Trayvon Martin to the importance of voting in the 2020 election. She's also been a vocal supporter for rape survivors, breast cancer victims, LGBTQ rights, and more, and for the mother of four children, whom she shares with husband Dwayne Wade. That is all very intentional indeed. To whom much is given, much is required. Me and my husband both take that very seriously, Union told me in an Instagram Live interview in November. But also, I have relied a lot on the kindness of strangers in my life. As a rape survivor, I needed a lot of things to be whole and healed and safe. I had to ask for a lot of help. She added, my husband grew up dealing with the addiction of his parents and dealing with food scarcity, so we're not really far removed from needing a lot of help. We just want to give back to what was given to us. What was poured into us, we want to pour back into other people. Giving back during a pandemic is particularly challenging, however. In search of a way to be philanthropic this holiday season while socially distancing, and to encourage others to do the same, Union has teamed up with Amazon to deliver smiles to charitable organizations. She's spotlighting companies who have been hit especially hard this year to help fulfill their Amazon Smile charity list of items they are most in need of. Union is working to fulfill the list for Deborah's Place, which provides supportive housing and services to women who are homeless, and Women's Center for Advancement, an organization in her hometown of Omaha, Nebraska that helps women, particularly victims of domestic violence, human trafficking and stalking, and their children stay safe. As a family, we were trying to figure out the best way to give back in a safe, COVID-friendly way, Union says. So if you just want to give, you can log on to Amazon's Delivering Smiles. Or like a lot of us who have started our holiday buying early, you can do your normal shopping through Amazon Smile, and a portion of the purchase price goes towards the charity of your choosing. And here is the interview with Gabrielle. How is your family? Today, as of this morning, we're all okay. Only one meltdown, and it wasn't the toddler. So we're doing pretty good today. Now ask me tomorrow, and it could be something else, but today we are okay. We are okay. What has the family social distancing situation been like in the last 8 months? Well, we've moved both of our moms, who have pre-existing conditions, out of hotspots and to Los Angeles nearby just to make sure that we were trying to keep an eye on and help as many of our family members as possible who are the most at risk. So our family has expanded a bit during COVID, but you know, we just try to keep within our little pod. Wear a mask, stay safe, we're watching a lot of Netflix, we're streaming, just trying to read a lot and also working a lot. I've not worked this much ever in my life. I'm just now doing it via Zoom. Your partnership with Amazon Smile is so great. In fact, we just released Oprah's Favorite Things, which is all on Amazon, so our readers can do their shopping and give back to charities at the same time. You and your husband, Dwayne, were recently named two of Time's most influential people of the year. You've always given back and been outspoken about what you believe in. Where does that need come from? You know where it comes from? Staying silent for a long time. Realizing that the notion of going along to get along or let me just keep my head down and maybe they won't notice me, you know, when I did that, I wasn't any safer. I wasn't in any way protected by my silence. I don't want that. It came from seeing something and not saying anything and watching a lot of ish go down on my watch, and it just doesn't feel good to me. So now that I'm in a position where speaking up can really make a huge difference, I'm going to keep speaking up. Not only does it feel good to my soul, I know I'm actually making a difference in the lives and opportunities of a lot of people. As long as I have a voice and breath in my body, I will continue to speak up and try to do right by as many marginalized folks as possible. What do the holidays look like in the Wade household? Do you have traditions? Will they be different this year? Yeah, we've never really been able to have traditions because my husband, when he played in the NBA, he usually played on Christmas. So Christmas might be on the 27th or on the 18th. So we've always had to be a little flexible and kind of just fly by the seat of our pants. Which leads me to one of our newest, I guess, traditions. Instead of singing Christmas carols, my mom introduced us to the original Broadway cast album of Dreamgirls with Jennifer Holliday and Cheryl Lee Ralph. So we listen to that every Christmas Eve and Christmas. And now that Dwayne has been folded into our family, he would like to incorporate the original cast album of Hamilton. So that's on the table right now. That may be part of our new tradition, all of us singing along. But that's really all we have. That and a plate of glazed ham. I have to tell you, our team at O, we are big fans of Kavya James, a.k.a. Shady Baby. Do you think she's going to be impressed by the holidays this year? You know what? She has no concept of holidays. I don't know if she's just not old enough or if she just literally doesn't care. It's hard to tell. She's very unbothered by most things. I don't know. I don't think she's old enough to care. She doesn't like a lot of, you know, around the holidays, people might drink a little more and things get a little loud. She's like, ooh, girl, you're on a 10 and you need to take it down a notch. I don't know what she's going to take away from the holidays. As long as she gets to watch Spirit, I think she's like, I don't care what the rest of you do. All she wants to do is watch Spirit. Kavya is Life Goals. Spirit by Beyonce, is that what she's watching? No, it's an animated show about horses. Oh, that was my reference. By Beyonce, of course. She is on her Beyonce, though. All about the single ladies. It was Boom Boom Pow, now it's Single Ladies. She's gotten this kind of, she hears this beat drop and she's like racing to the dance floor even when there's no dance floor. That's as far as her Beyonce has gotten. We need all the Kavya dance videos. Okay, so you mentioned you've been working more during this pandemic. What's happening in your world? Because I haven't been able to actually start filming anything, I've been working on all of the projects that we're developing with my production company. We've been able to sell projects during the pandemic. We've been able to really work on our development and get some of our shows that we've sold from maybe A, but maybe not to quite Z, but further along in a quicker way. One of the things that has gotten me through is working to provide more opportunities for our creatives, who are all pretty much from marginalized communities. So basically, I've been doing the work that I benefited from other people who came before me who were like, I don't want to watch you struggle. I am going to bust my ass to make sure that I'm providing more opportunities for women of color, for LGBTQ communities, and any marginalized voice. I'm just trying to center us in our own narratives being created by us. So yeah, that's been very fulfilling. And I've been nonstop, usually sometimes from 7 or 8 if it's on the East Coast to 6 p.m., but nothing feels as good as providing opportunities for other people and watching somebody be like, yes! Thank you for doing that work. Before I let you go, I do have to ask, drop the skincare routine. How do you get that glow? Fenty, because I got to support my girl, and she just keep dropping the freshness. But I have been experimenting throughout quarantine because we've got nothing to do except stare at our faces, pick out different things. I'm loving this company called The Things We Do. It's a skincare line created by a marginalized woman, and it's everything. It is so good. So go to their website, go to their Instagram, check out all their products. I use the Glow Scrub Cleanser, the Black Currant Oil, the Do-Over. Literally, I bought the whole thing because I was like, my lower face is falling off. I love that company. No ad, that's just who I like. The creator of that line is Vanessa Lee. You can find her on Instagram. Thank you, Gabrielle, so much. Okay, this next article is called I Survived the Holocaust and Went On to Thrive in Hollywood. What amazed me most is how resilient humans are. I was married for 42 beautiful years, and I almost missed meeting my wife because I was tired and didn't want to shave. It was 1953, and my friend Arthur had insisted I drive him to a dance at the University Synagogue in Los Angeles. When we got there, I told him, I'm going to nap in the car. You go in. Soon he came back with two girls and he said, they want to meet the Continental. That was the name of a late night TV show where the host had a European accent like mine and the name of the salon I just opened, the Continental House of Beauty. One of the girls, June, looked like Jennifer Jones from that picture, Love is a Many Splendored Thing. She was so intelligent. Her friends called her the Walking Encyclopedia. Later, when we were married, we would go to parties at my clients' homes with big movie stars, and afterward June would say, Bill, I looked around the room. Nobody was better than you. That's how she felt. I started washing and ironing my own clothes back in Czechoslovakia at age 7 because my mother had to work. She supported 6 kids as a highly skilled dressmaker. After World War I, my father was in and out of veterans' hospitals. When the Germans took over our city in 1944, they noticed him walking with a cane, very frail, and beat him so badly. He died soon after. 3 weeks later, they established a ghetto in an old brick factory and took us all into it. My mother and my two sisters, who still lived at home, my aunt and my cousins. After 6 weeks, they piled us into a cattle car headed to Auschwitz. As soon as we got there, they herded the men into one storage facility and the women into another. Those structures had no walls, just roofs, and all of us were naked. I tried to keep track of my mother and my aunt, but oh, it was terrible to see their humiliation. Then they separated those who would go to the gas chamber from those of us who were young and healthy enough to work. That's when I lost sight of everyone. They marched us past the gas chamber to the barracks. I was in a trance. It was impossible to understand what I was seeing. What I remember most are the people who were already in the barracks, their swollen faces and eyes. They didn't look like human beings, just skeletons with skin. One day they gave us a bowl of soup that 5 or 6 of us had to share, passing it from mouth to mouth. I couldn't bring myself to eat it. The people from my city who were there told me, Vilmos, if you don't eat, you're going to die. You never get used to it. being stripped of every inch of human dignity. But I wanted to survive. Eventually, I drank from the bowl. Auschwitz was a hell place. I stepped outside the barracks at 4 a.m. for roll call and saw dead people, piled on one another like garbage, so high that I had to look up to see the sky. But I was lucky. I was only in Auschwitz for about 12 days before I got picked for a work detail in the Bavarian mountains. I worked there for almost a year, rebuilding a gas refinery every day after the Allies bombed it at night, digging tunnels through the mountains for train tracks. When the SS realized they were losing the war, they took us to Buchenwald, then ran to save their own lives. I was frozen stiff. Thinking I was dead, they threw me in with the bodies being carried to the crematoria. One of the prisoners who worked there noticed I was alive and brought me to the infirmary. I woke up 5 days later to learn we had been liberated. I heard, "The Americans are here." But I was too weak and numb to feel any real joy. Soon after, I learned that my mother, my aunt, my cousin, and her children were gassed immediately after we arrived at Auschwitz. I cried for 3 months in a displaced persons camp in Germany. Then I realized that with all of my crying, my mother was still not coming back. I decided, if you feel sorry for yourself, you won't have a life. You have to choose. So I emigrated to the United States. I never talked about my experiences during the Holocaust with my wife. She was born in America, and I felt it is very difficult for people who don't come from this background to understand. The only reason I was able to make a life for myself is that I blocked out some of what happened. I don't even remember the name of the person who slept next to me in the barracks. Such a nice young man. We were so close in such a horrible condition. I forgot his name on purpose, otherwise I might remember everything. 3 days after I arrived in New York, the boat I was on docked the 31st of August, 1946. I got a job as an errand boy in an international beauty shop where the staff spoke some of the same 5 languages I did. That way I was able to learn English and make a living. By the end of that year, I was styling hair for the stars of Radio City Music Hall, Broadway, the Metropolitan Opera. These beautiful ladies showered me with tips, and after 3.5 years, I saved enough to move to Los Angeles, where I had an uncle I'd never met. I went to night school, earned my U.S. high school diploma and California cosmetology license in 6 months, and eventually opened 2 beauty shops where I worked with Judy Garland and other big stars. For years, I saw my mother in my dreams. My only regret is that I couldn't save her or make the end of her life more comfortable. But I was able to help my sisters and their families immigrate to the U.S., educate my nephew and my daughters, and care for my wife when she was sick with cancer. I still live in the same Los Angeles neighborhood we moved into 65 years ago. Everybody knocks on my door. My grandsons call me for advice almost every day. For me, what's remarkable is how a human being can recuperate from a corpse to a human again. When the war ended, I was 21 years old. 72 pounds. I couldn't even stand. Now I'm 96, and here I am. This next article is called "Having Polio as a Child Prepared Me to Survive the COVID Pandemic." A virus with no cure or vaccine, quarantining, not being able to see a single member of my family. I'm deeply saddened by the COVID pandemic, like everyone else. And sometimes thinking about it makes me go drifting back to the loneliest period of my life. The first time I heard the word polio was over my shoulder. Parents at the time were terrified. They had seen the March of Dimes posters of children in leg braces, newspaper pictures of rows of patients in iron lungs. But my mother maintained a very low-key, don't-scare-the-inmates response to fear-inspiring events, at least among me and my brothers. Then one day when I was 5 years old, I was playing in our driveway with the neighborhood kids, and I suddenly felt ice cold. As I was struggling up the front steps, a girl behind me said to my mother, "Mrs. Tully, she could have polio. My uncle does." That was September 15th, 1953. As an Irish Catholic girl, I always recall that I got polio on the Feast of Our Lady of Sorrows. Within 3 days, my muscle pain turned into paralysis. I lost the ability to get up. My parents took me to the hospital for a spinal tap, the only way to diagnose polio back then. When they knew I had it, the doctors put me in an isolation room. My folks were allowed to visit for only 15 minutes twice a day and had to stay at the door the entire time. The toys they brought me had to be burned for fear of infection. When I see pictures of people waving at their loved ones through nursing home windows now, I remember how terrible that was. I lay in bed for 10 days. I couldn't move anything but my head. When my fever finally broke, I was taken to St. Charles, a little Catholic hospital not too far from our home in Brooklyn that was run by nuns, the Daughters of Wisdom. The 17 of us in the girls' ward lived in an alternate universe with a schoolroom set up for kids in beds and wheelchairs. I'll never forget the loneliness of that time or the pain. Polio makes your muscles contract and paralyze. I had to lie there while the physical therapist tried to stretch them out again. After 3 months of excruciating physical therapy, a doctor said to my mother, "Good news, her toe is moving." Mom's reaction was, "You can do better than that." She always made me feel that I could do whatever I wanted. After a while, I walked with back and leg braces and crutches and used a wheelchair for distance. After 2 years in the hospital, I got to go home. While I thought I'd keep getting better and end up like everyone else, eventually the doctors told me my condition would never improve. That was the hardest thing to hear. Luckily, our local school got an elevator, so I was able to attend, starting in 7th grade. Trying to fit in gave me something to focus on. From then on, my goal was to live as normally as I could. When I was 24, I moved to Seattle, away from the close-knit family I relied on, and built my own life working with troubled teens, then in sex education related to disabilities. I met a gorgeous guy at an Alfred Hitchcock festival when he offered to push my wheelchair up the hill. We got married and adopted a son I'm crazy about. Once I got post-polio syndrome, I had to use a wheelchair permanently, plus a vent to help me breathe. Then I concentrated on being a mom. The doctors told me I should not expect to live past the age of 30, so I'm grateful I've extended my sell-by date by 4 decades. And that we got a vaccine, even if it came too late for me. I love being alive. I feel there are still things I can do. Not all of those girls who were in St. Charles with me made it. I remember them. And I try to justify the fact that I got to keep going. Okay, now we have an article called How to Find Your Inner Peace and Happiness Now. Inner peace is possible, and you don't need to meditate on a mountaintop or break the bank for a beach yoga retreat in order to find it. Carving out time to relax is wonderful, but it's amid the frantic pace of everyday life when we need serenity the most. After all, we don't live in a yoga retreat. You live in the real world. That moment when you're stuck in the pharmacy line and the contents of your bag spill on the floor just as your phone starts ringing? That's when you need to find inner peace within yourself, right as you're suppressing the urge to unleash a stream of four-letter words. I think often people look for circumstances to help achieve a sense of inner peace, says Ashley Davis Bush, psychotherapist and author of The Little Book of Inner Peace, Simple Practices for Less Angst, More Calm. In fact, this calm, compassionate, deep awareness is actually within each person. It's as if we have a deep reservoir of peacefulness and serenity inside us. What we have to learn to do is tap into it. With the help of what Bush calls micro practices, you can get better at accessing your inner calm, even if it's been hiding for a while. The problem is most of us live sort of on the surface of the waves, where there's a lot of turbulence and wildness, says Davis. But again, this deep, calm awareness is actually within each person. Davis maintains that you don't need to shut out all the noise to find inner peace. There's this assumption that if you're in a quiet place, it will be more conducive to accessing the spot within. But in fact, there are people who have panic attacks while they're on the massage table. You could be on a New York City subway, surrounded by people and noise, and close your eyes and go into the space where your calmness resides. Breathe in, breathe out. Your breath is always with you, and both yoga and meditation practices harness the power of breath control to help shift your state of mind. Davis likes to recommend practicing the 4-7-8 breath, which is based on the time-tested yoga technique, because you can do it anywhere at any time. Close your mouth and inhale through your nose as you count to 4. Hold on to that breath as you count to 7, and then exhale through your mouth for the count of 8. The long exhale helps stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is basically initiating a relaxation response in your body, Davis says. Make sure to breathe really low to fill your belly with air. Remind yourself that you're breathing, and hopefully you're physically protected, says Julie Potiker, mindful self-compassion teacher and author of Life Falls Apart, but you don't have to. Mindful methods for staying calm in the midst of chaos. Think about the people you care about, and the people who care about you, she suggests, saying that focusing on that can lower your panic response. Let the truth of that warm your heart. Read the story you're telling yourself. If you find yourself spiraling over a perceived disappointment, frustration, or panic-inducing thought, try stepping back to assess whether or not what your brain is telling you is true. Examining the source of your turmoil can make it feel smaller in size. I tell my students that what you resist persists, and they need to feel it to heal it, Potiker says. She often recommends the RAIN technique, an acronym first coined by meditation teacher Michelle McDonald. R stands for recognize. Recognize what's happening. Label the emotion, because simply naming it calms down your over-arousal, says Potiker. A stands for allow. Allow your situation to be there. You're not resisting it or trying to numb it and run away from it, she says. You're allowing it to be there long enough to work with it. I stands for investigate. Potiker says to ask yourself, what most wants my attention? What am I believing? Where am I experiencing these feelings in my body? Can I put my hands on where I'm feeling it and soften the area? All of this inquiry is done with love, not judgment. N stands for nourish. This is alternately defined as natural loving awareness. You've observed yourself, and it's time to treat yourself with loving kindness. Ask yourself, what do I need to hear right now, Potiker says. Just talking to yourself like you would a dear friend is extremely helpful and healing. It staves off the feeling of isolation. Or act your way to deeper self-compassion. There's no one road to self-compassion, so here's another way to think of it. Davis suggests trying a 3-step method she calls ACT, based on the work of Kristen Neff, a prominent researcher in the field of self-compassion. A is for acknowledge, as in you acknowledge your suffering or your struggle. This really sucks, Davis says. C is for connect, connecting to all common humanity to remember that you are not alone in this. Other people get frustrated, feel angry, or impatient. The T is to talk kindly to yourself. When it comes to positive self-talk, Davis echoes Potiker's recommendation to address yourself as you would a friend, because using I sentences may make you feel more isolated. Research shows that when you talk to yourself in the third person, you actually activate the care circuit in your brain, so that you feel more cared for. You're accessing your higher self so that you can talk yourself off the ledge and you feel more supported. So I would say, Ashley, you're going to be okay. This is a really hard moment, but don't forget, Ashley, you're not alone in this. Make a joy list for when you need it later. While a compassionate inventory of how you're feeling is a powerful mindfulness exercise, Potiker says asking yourself, what do I need to do right now, can remind you to lean on actions that tend to give you peace. Since many people find it challenging to remember which activities bring them joy when they're currently feeling mired in chaos, Potiker recommends looking to a joy list that you've compiled ahead of time. Free associate what brings you joy, and then pick something on the list to do when you're feeling lousy, she says. While you're doing that thing, such as flower arranging or baking, savor it. Take it in for a few minutes, because taking in the good rewires your brain for happiness and resilience, Potiker says, citing the work of psychologist Rick Hansen, PhD. Try to fully give yourself over to the moment. You can do this multiple times a day, she says, building up a joy reserve by just savoring those first sips of morning coffee or the sound of a child giggling. Cultivate gratitude for what's happening and not happening. The psychological benefits of gratitude have been championed repeatedly in the field of happiness research, and according to Davis, practicing gratitude is another way to quickly access that state of inner peace. She suggests two simple ways to get into the habit: keeping a gratitude journal and smiling as soon as you sit up in bed in the morning. When you smile, it signals to your brain that things are good and that you're happy. If you find yourself struggling to think of what you're grateful for in the heat of a chaotic or frustrating moment, Davis suggests that you start by naming what you're glad isn't happening, and boom, now you've got something to be thankful for. To go back to the earlier subway example, in a crowded commute, you might think, oh, I'm glad I'm not being mugged right now. Or I'm glad it's actually moving and we're not stuck. I'm glad it's air conditioned. I'm glad I have a seat. I'm glad I have a physically healthy body. One small positive thought often sparks another. Ask yourself two questions daily. Your gratitude journal entries don't need to be lengthy reflections like some burdensome daily homework assignment. Instead, use these two simple prompts to list an item or two for each. What did I enjoy today? And what am I grateful for today? Maybe you did something that's on your joy list, for example. And serve others to help yourself too. Everybody knows that when you help other people, you feel better, Potiker says. Even in the coronavirus pandemic, there are plenty of ways to help, including dropping off canned goods or volunteering virtually. Those in the field of positive psychology believe that the good feelings that come from truly meaningful acts cultivate something they've deemed eudaimonic happiness. Over decades, research has suggested that in the long term, the eudaimonic happiness that people feel from doing something like volunteering or making someone else feel good is more rewarding and longer lasting than the more commonly pursued hedonic well-being, which prioritizes seeking pleasure and minimizing pain. Thus, building up a reserve of eudaimonic happiness through acts of service could potentially up your general inner peace baseline. Maintain good self-care hygiene. Eating right, getting plenty of sleep, exercising, meditating, and practicing what Potiker calls mindfulness daily life activities can all shore up your mental peace defenses for when all hell breaks loose, in your world or in your head. Even while you're just brushing your teeth, you can focus on feeling the toothbrush, tasting the toothpaste, and hearing the sounds, so you're not worrying about your to-do list or what just happened in the news, she says. That's a mindfulness in daily life activity. It's all about developing the pause, so that when you feel yourself reacting to a situation, you're better prepared to respond in a calmer way. Practice acceptance. In the larger pursuit of learning to access your inner peace, Davis says that accepting the existence of things that are out of your control is the long-term goal, difficult as it may be. Acceptance is an overall way of engaging with life, she explains, so it's less about a quick practice and more about a life orientation. When we resist our circumstances, we create a lot of suffering, which of course is the opposite of inner peace, she continues. And the second you start going with the flow and putting yourself in alignment with what is, you immediately start to have a sense of flowing with, rather than flowing against. It's a challenging process, and one your brain may resist on impulse at first. That's why it's called practice. You may not nail it the first, 15th, or 50th time, and that is normal. In terms of a practice, I might say to someone, right when you're in a situation like you're in a long grocery line, you just can't believe it. You're late for something. You're feeling really stressed. Just stop. Drop into your heart space and say, this is what I've got. This is where I am. I'm just going to flow with this. And I'm going to look for an opportunity now to just practice patience and practice self-compassion. This is really hard. I wish I could be faster. I wish I wasn't in this line, but I am. It's okay, and I'm okay. Okay, this next article is called Barack Obama Says Leaving the White House Was a Huge Relief for His Marriage. And there's a picture of Barack and Michelle dancing and smiling at each other. During his tenure as the 44th president of the United States, a lot of things kept Barack Obama up at night. If it wasn't Afghanistan or the economic crisis on his mind, it was his strained marriage to First Lady Michelle Obama. In a new sit-down interview with People, Obama detailed how much his political aspirations put a damper on their marriage. Michelle very much believed in the work I did, but was less optimistic about what I could get done. She's more skeptical about politics and more mindful of the sacrifices to the family, he told the outlet. Obama's presidency came with thrills and obstacles, but for Michelle, the pressure, the stress of needing to get everything right, to be on at every moment, became a heavy burden for her to carry. Obama admits he recognized his wife's unhappiness, and his easygoing attitude toward things didn't exactly make her feel supported. I tend to be, that'll be fine, and I worry a little bit less, just temperamentally, he adds. He continues, there were times where I think she was frustrated or sad or angry, but knew that I had Afghanistan or the financial crisis to worry about, so she would tamp it down. It took leaving the White House for good for the couple to finally breathe a sigh of relief, as the former First Lady was able to be more open and vulnerable about how she felt during their White House years. You know the old adage, if mom's happy, everybody's happy? It very much applies in our household, he jokingly told the outlet. Now Obama says the couple's post-White House life brought them closer together and allowed them to be friends again, since their daughters are much older now, and Michelle doesn't have to be super mom all the time. All right, and now we have fascinating facts about Princess Anne, Queen Elizabeth II's daughter. Season 3 of The Crown introduced us to an entirely new cast of regal characters, including one of our favorite royals, Princess Anne, also known as the Princess Royal, the second child and only daughter of Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip. Rising British actress Erin Doherty plays the princess through Season 4. Princess Anne honestly didn't mean anything to me, Doherty told The Telegraph. Like a lot of people who grew up in Britain, I think the royal family was always just there. I had to research her, and then I realized, wow, this woman is awesome. I fell in love with her. And though we don't see nearly as much of Princess Anne in Season 4, Doherty's portrayal of the Princess Royal, who is now 70, is pretty spot on. Here's what to know about the pro-equestrian who is 14th in line to the British throne. Princess Anne went viral in 2019. In December 2019, a video of the princess went viral. In the clip, Queen Elizabeth II, Prince Charles, and Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, greet President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump for a reception at Buckingham Palace. You soon see the Queen gesture to her daughter Anne, who is visible at the edge of the frame, to come say hello to the POTUS and FLOTUS as well. But the Princess Royal appears to simply shrug her shoulders in what many called a defiant gesture. But as it turns out, there was an explanation for the interaction. A friend told Vanity Fair last year, the princess was unhappy to be dragged into that particular story because she has always been careful not to be seen to be political in any way. She is also incredibly respectful, so any suggestion that she would laugh at anyone behind their backs was quite upsetting for her. But one of the best things that came out of that video? The acknowledgement of Anne's superb track record. People are surprised that Princess Anne can hang. That woman was once the victim of an attempted kidnapping, and when she was told to get out of her car at gunpoint, she said, "Not bloody likely." Anne and Princess Diana's relationship was reportedly rocky. In a piece published by Vanity Fair in November, royal biographer Ingrid Seward told the magazine that the two women consistently clashed. Anne was indifferent to Diana from the very beginning. She called her a silly girl, Seward said. And royal reporter Richard Kay told the Express Anne, who was 11 years older, did not have time for Diana. She didn't like the way she went about her duty and the way she used the cameras and the media to promote herself in her eyes. Anne has had a much more traditional approach to monarchy and royal duty. She's an Olympic equestrian. Princess Anne is the first royal to compete in the Olympics after she qualified for the equestrian three-day event in 1976 Montreal Games. She's also won a gold medal and two silver medals at the European three-day event championships in 1971 and 1975. I thought if I was going to do anything outside of the royal family, horses was likely to be the best way of doing it, she told Vanity Fair. The princess is a member of the International Olympic Committee and the president of the British Olympic Association. Anne did not give her kids, Peter and Zara, royal titles. Anne and Phillips share two children, Peter Phillips, 43, and Zara Tyndall, 39. Neither have official titles like their mother, as they're only inherited through royal sons, and their parents declined the courtesy titles offered by Queen Elizabeth II. I'm very lucky that both my parents decided not to use the title, and we grew up and did all the things that gave us the opportunity to do, Zara told the Times in 2015. Peter is the Queen's oldest grandchild and married Canadian management consultant Autumn Kelly in 2008. They have two daughters, Savannah, 9, and Isla, 8. Like her mother, Zara is also an Olympic equestrian and earned silver in the team event in the 2012 London Games. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.